Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello there and welcome to this interview on the Lotus Eaters website. Thank you for joining us. I am joined today by Cyan Quinn, the director of the White Papers Policy Institute, who describe themselves as a team of analysts, former and current policy professionals, activists and volunteers who work together to craft policy alternatives that promote the collective interests of Western peoples who seek self-determination. Cyan here does make speeches at conferences and also produces work for the Institute itself, as well as acting as their director. Thank you very much for joining us today, Cyan.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure. I love your show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So let's get into the details of it then. So for anybody who's unaware, anyone in our audience who is unaware of the White Papers Policy Institute, when and why did you begin? What was the motivation for starting an institute such as your own?
Well, thank you. That's a great question. So my co-founder and I met each other in about 2019, and we were both attending the same conference that was centered around the issue of demographics. So demographics is a relatively new topic that's being discussed internationally because globalism is relatively new internationally. It's been the historic norm that countries maintained a general ethnic majority of their founding people for all of history up until the migrant crisis of about 2015. And so we were attending the same conference. We were interested in the same ideas. My co-founder has a degree in foreign policy and political economy. And my background is in lobbying, political philosophy, and nonprofits. And so we thought at the time, you know, this is a new issue that's being discussed. We, as a civilization, are now on a global stage. We have we're used to minority ethnic groups having their own interest groups, their own lobbies, and their own avenues of representation in our countries. But now that we're facing demographic change in our countries, it's time for us to start seriously discussing having our own interest groups that promote our interests, because we're valid too.
Yeah, absolutely. And in trying to achieve those goals and sort of put forward our own interests, I've seen that you both look at U.S. policy and U.K. policy. What are your targets for U.S. policy, U.K. policy, Western policy in general? What kind of ideas are you formulating, advocating, and writing up in your articles and policy proposals regarding demographic change and how it should be targeted and combated?
Right. Well, the number one issue in demographic change is that our countries have swiftly become minority ethnically British and minority ethnically American, for example. And this has all happened without the consent of the original founding population. We've been told that we need immigrants for labor, we need foreign doctors, we need foreigners to work in agriculture and to pick the fruit. But every time people in our countries have been asked, we've always said, no, we don't want that. And if you look at the trends, this is something that was put in place over the last 60 or 80 years. And it's something that could also be gradually reversed in the next 60 to 80 years, but it has to be deliberate, and it has to be something that is a combination of both deliberate policies and voluntary remigration strategies. So remigration is the number one issue that we're facing, because once we can retain a demographic majority, then we can more accurately focus on policies that make sense for us.
All right, then. And you say it was about, 60 to 80 years ago that these sorts of changes start to happen in our countries. And obviously, if you want to solve a problem, you need to identify the problem accurately. You need to identify where the start of the problem comes from. So for the interests of educating the audience, where would you identify the beginning of mass migration into the West. Obviously, everybody can pinpoint it happened sometime after the end of the Second World War. In the UK and America, when does it really start, and when does which pieces of political legislation really start to accelerate it? Because we always have to take into account it is legislation, it's practical policy that has pushed these things and created pull factors for people to come into our countries. Where would you identify the beginning of this? And also, what would you say, because we're talking about the level of migration into our countries right now, the demographic levels, what's the current rate of demographic change in the US as well? Because we have the numbers on paper, and then we have the real numbers as well, because in the UK we have all of this trouble knowing about how, like, they like to hide the information from us. I read a very interesting article on your website the other day talking about the ways in which, like, Sweden and other countries across Europe are trying to hide these statistics from people. I've thrown quite a bit at you there. What do you suspect the current rate of demographic change is, and where do you see it as beginning, and with which pieces of legislation?
I would say the most dramatic change has happened since, in the United States, you can point directly to the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, and that's something that eliminated quotas from places in the third world. So up until that point, it was the norm that we wanted to protect the ethnic majority in the United States. We saw that as a natural good. We saw that people who were culturally and ethnically similar to each other lived in more harmonious societies, and that was accepted as the norm. And in fact, that act was passed with the promise that it would not disrupt the ethnic balance of the United States. And during that time, a similar cultural shift was happening in the UK. And you brought up something important, and I'm just going to take a quick side note here, that we focus internationally. So I'm based in the United States. We have a UK policy writer, Joseph Bright. He's based in the UK. We have several people who are from other countries, such as the Netherlands, Germany, Austria, Italy, Portugal. And the reason we have such a broad focus is because we're all in this change together. And we have things such as the EU Migration Pact that have been put together by an international policy elite that have been put in place. And so we need to combat that too on an international level as a civilization as a whole. We all have things in common. We may be different countries. We may be very different. We may have our own eccentricities, but we're in this boat together. So now going back to the rate of demographic change. So for example, I pointed to 1965 in the United States, very similar in the UK. You have the Immigration Act of 1971. And in our country, we went from being about 85% ethnically American, ethnically Western in 1965 to now, it's as of the last census, it was about 56%. That is an extremely dramatic change. And in some cities, they went from being majority ethnically American to a very, very small minority in just a matter of the last few decades. So this is relatively new, and it's something that has been a bit of a shock, and it's something that people aren't happy about. And when we look at that, when we look at other outlets, there are plenty of other influencers, news outlets, publications, philosophy journals that cover why it's important to maintain an ethnic majority and why that's a natural good. And the purpose of our institution is to come in and say, well, this is how we can restore that ethnic majority. And so the main things that we propose on our website are remigration policies. And this is a combination of mandatory remigration policies. And this includes the humane deportation of illegal immigrants, the deportation of foreign criminals. And the UK actually has a lot of provisions for deportation and denaturalization that other countries such as the US doesn't. So it could be a model if the Home Office decided to make it one. So our it's a combination of these mandatory remigration policies and then also voluntary remigration policies. The voluntary part is interesting and also unique to us because when you ask these minority groups, people have this assumption that minority groups who are here don't want to leave or won't leave. When the reality is, a lot of immigrants are migrants for economic reasons, and they come here for economic reasons, but they have a cultural tie to their homeland. And so they can also leave for economic reasons with the appropriate incentives. So, for example, I'll go into that in a little bit more detail. In the UK specifically, there was a poll that was done by the marketing group Word on the Curve, and they polled people of color in working age, ages 18 to what was the retirement age? I don't remember the
65.
retirement age, but they polled the working age people of color in Britain, and the result was that 66% would like to leave the UK or were actively planning on doing so. So, why don't we make that a reality for them?
So that would also presumably include multi-generational immigrants into this country as well. The descent, if it's that working age, this wouldn't necessarily amount to just purely people who are just off of the boat. This would presumably also mean they're descendants of people who've been here for a few decades at this point, which does suggest that the people feel a strong pull factor to their original country of origin.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And actually, there was a great documentary that I was watching. I think it came out last year, and it was by the BBC on French Senegalese second and third generation immigrants who actually wanted to go back to Senegal. And the documentary covered their voluntary remigration journey back to Senegal. And this was without any incentives at all. Of course, the BBC took the angle that this is a bad thing, and it interviewed some of the people who used them as home workers, or house nurses or other low-level jobs. And they said, "Oh, we're losing an integral part of our community." Well, if you ask the people directly who wanted to go back to Senegal, the reason they want to do that is because they felt a cultural tie there. And they also realized that there are business opportunities there in Senegal that aren't available for them in France. And this is, I think, if we start listening to what they tell us, that could be a monumental shift in our mindset and would actually allow us to get these policies done and to allow for remigration without any of the violent fantasies that come out about civil war. I think that that's impractical.
I think it's very important to dissuade people from spreading those sorts of violent fantasies that you're talking about, or giving people a misleading notion that it would lead to that as some kind of inevitability. It's something that does concern people, but we shouldn't be behaving as though it's some kind of inevitability. In fact, and this is something that say, for instance, a managerial politician like Tony Blair has always been very good at presenting the policies that he was pushing when he was British Prime Minister as having already been inevitable. We have to approach our policies from the kinds of position where we understand them as being inevitable and being able to be done in an orderly way. And on that, you mentioned the shockingly fast rate of demographic change in America. It reminded me, I was reading another article on your website And I would recommend all of our viewers to actually not only check out the Twitter page and the other resources that you can find, the Substack, but the website is a great resource as well. It was kind of a love letter to Michigan and the state of Michigan, all of the amazing things that have been created in Michigan. You know, it's Detroit and Henry Ford and the production line. And it brought to mind the Dearborn being in the news quite a lot recently, given some of the protests that have been going on there, and the way that, you know, 100 years ago that was like a manufacturing town. It was Henry Ford's town, and he was the guy who put it on the map, and it was a town, it was known for all of its innovations, and now it's completely unrecognizable to where it was 100 years ago, which I always think is a, personally, I think that's a complete tragedy with anywhere, because with the movement of people, with the displacement of people, displaces that culture, displaces all of those things that made it such an amazing place to begin with. But on the concept of, that was just a thought of mine there, on the concept of remigration, when we talk about it being orderly, we talk about it being peaceful. So the concept of remigration has popped into being over the past few years and has become very trendy for people to talk about it on social media. But because of the fact that there are so many different voices talking about remigration, it can paint a rather confused picture of what remigration is and what remigration should be and how far remigration should go. So I'm interested to your specific understanding of it, for a working understanding. I'm also interested that you mentioned that the UK has all of these provisions that could be used to readily implement remigration, that could be used as a model for other countries as well. So explain to me how that would look, because a lot of people do have this worry that it's going to end up just being, you know, like stormtroopers showing up in the middle of the night, knocking on the door and yanking out somebody who lives next door to you purely because they got the color swatch out and you were just a shade too brown. So how can we assuage people's fears on such things, and what would a practical policy of remigration look like, using the example of how Britain could implement it, if you can get that off the top of your head?
That's right. No. I think that you're right. There's a lot of misconceptions out there about what that might look like. You know, people come up with these imaginary scenarios where your neighbor is, you're right, yanked out of their house for being a shade too brown or something like that. That's not what we're looking at here, in any sense of the word. What, like I indicated before, our demographic change has happened over the last period of 40 or 50 or 60 years. It can also be reversed humanely and gradually. The plan that we propose takes place in about 12 years. And so that accounts for about three parliamentary terms, not anticipating any snap elections. And what we propose is a combination of the mandatory remigration policies and voluntary. So we'll go ahead and start off with the mandatory. So what we mean by mandatory is, first, deporting all illegal immigrants. And I think most people would agree that this is a good thing. There's about 1.2 million illegal immigrants right now in the UK, and it's if you include their children and their dependents, it comes to about 1.35. So that's about 2% of the population. These people could be removed. We also believe in family reunification. Obviously, if you're a minor child and you come here with illegal immigrant parents, we don't want there to be family separation. We believe in keeping you together and then deported to your home country where they belong. And again, that process doesn't have to be violent or crazy. It can be something that is very simple and systemic. You can do it both through regular deportation procedures, where you are picked up, you're housed properly, you're fed, and then you're returned on a, these aren't cattle cars, these are planes, you can watch movies. In America, we had we actually have a stipend now for our illegal immigrants. So you can take advantage of the Customs and Border Patrol app, and you can say, yes, I would like to, instead of waiting for ICE to come get me, I can sign up to be for deportation and I can receive a stipend. It started out at $1,000 and then they increased it to 3,000, and right now I think they settled around 2,600. They found that that was the sweet spot to entice more people to take advantage of it. And that's a stipend on top of your moving expenses and giving you a time to get your affairs in order. So it's actually a really humane process if you look at it, in practice. So we would start off with illegal immigrants and their children. The next is we would ask, did this individual obtain their citizenship through fraud, false representation, or concealment? There's evidence to suggest that there's anywhere between 70 to 80% of these cases have been obtained fraudulently. One of the things that we can point to
And
back in
this
the
is in the
US,
US.
in the US and the UK. So,
In the UK as well, that many could be fraudulent.
that many, yes, actually, there was a the Home Office has been really relaxed about this. There was a famous case in 2021 of an Albanian who had been here, committed immigration fraud multiple times, and he was just never deported because of the incompetence of the Home Office. So this is something that if the Home Office was serious about it. So that's the UK. Back in the US, we have the Reagan amnesty, and there was an investigation into that particular amnesty, and they also found fraud there. Our estimates, when we put together our British remigration policy proposal, you find that on the website, we're using 50%, which is a really conservative number given the evidence. So if the Home Office were serious and decided to both investigate this potential fraud and then act on it, that could be a very significant drop in the non-European, non-British population. And then the third is unique to the UK and also is something that is perfectly reasonable. We ask the question, has the person conducted his or herself in a manner that's seriously prejudicial to the vital interests of the UK? In the Immigration, Asylum, and Naturalization Act of 2006, this allows for the denaturalization of people who have dual citizenship, foreigners, if it is conducive to the public good. We actually saw a little bit of action around that back around the time of the October 7th, when the Israel-Palestine war broke out again. There was a lot of discussion on removing people who were pro-Palestinian, both in the UK and in the US. And so if we can do it in those circumstances where we're concerned for a foreign ally, we should be able to stand up for our own interests as a nation.
Yeah, and I can certainly think of a community that that would apply to in Britain. Just earlier today on the podcast, I was talking about Rupert Lowe's Rape Gang Inquiry, which is looking into the horrifying phenomenon of grooming rape gangs across the UK. Of course, famously, majority of those were committed by Pakistanis. And this is one of the things that we found through all of these inquiries and all of the discoveries that go on throughout this is that it was not just one-off independent siloed gangs abusing like smaller groups of girls. These were kind of like nationwide industrialized gangs who were all operating alongside one another with community-wide involvement, where in some cases, like in Telford, for instance, if you were to arrest everybody who was involved in that, you'd be arresting a significant portion of the male population, and that's just for direct involvement, not to mention community complicity with wives, imams, family members all being aware and permitting it as well. So certainly you would be able to make an argument that an entire community there would have the grounds to be denaturalized, because a lot of those people, this is something that some people in the civic nationalist sense don't find very comfortable to talk about, a lot of those people were legal immigrants. They did come over fair and square using the system, and then still went on to do all of these horrifying things anyway, because ultimately, whether they got in legally or illegally, the character of these communities remains the same. It's just whether they've been rubber stamped officially to get through. And so on that, so how would we address, how are you addressing legal versus illegal immigration? Because obviously we've got the illegals as well, but legal immigration, particularly in a country like America, which does seem to be have a certain part of its national identity founded on itself being the land of opportunity, what sort of the legitimate arguments that you should be able to make against legal migration, and whether people who've say been here for 50, 60, 80 years should be sent back to their original countries of origin? How would you expect that most people would be able to get along with that?
Well, I first want to pick apart one of the issues that you brought up, which is and this is a common misconception. Mm-hmm. In the United States, we've built a national identity around being the land of opportunity. That is relatively new. And for the majority of American history, it has been the accepted norm that America is for Americans, the ethnic group that created it. It was only until, again, we're looking at the era around the 1965 Immigration Act, it was only then when the idea of the nation of immigrants came out. And this was brought to the American public through the posthumously published Nation of Immigrants essay from JFK that was actually commissioned before his death by the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. So it's not something that had been in our national vocabulary before. It's not something that we had thought about before. And again, going back to the time, if you look at the congressional record, those are the arguments defending the ethnic character of the United States that the majority of people did not want any change or did not want to be an economic zone for the rest of the world. So it was only during that time, and I would call it, frankly, it was a mass marketing campaign. We were subjected to a mass marketing campaign around that time in the post-World War II era that told us that humans are economic units, and instead of being part of this longer history of ancestry, nationality, ethnicity, and culture that we deserve to be proud of. So number one, I would say we need to dismantle that argument. The people are not economic units, and we need to stop thinking that way. It hasn't been the norm.
Just on that point quickly before you move on, when you talk about the 1965 Immigration Act in America, I have read some very in-depth works on that, and one of the standout quotes that I found supporting what you're saying there on the idea that it was sold to the people that it would not change fundamentally the demographic makeup of America was, I believe, one of the sponsors of the bill, I think was a Democrat, who said that if it did change the demographic status of Americans, that he would eat the bill.
He would eat the bill? Oh, I didn't know that. Is it Edward Kennedy?
I don't know if it was one of the Kennedys. I would need to refer back to the book that I read. There's a book that I've read by a very controversial author who I will not name right now because people might raise an eyebrow. Either way, there is a full chapter on the influence campaign to get Americans to support it, or the influence campaign to open up immigration in America. And there are a number of quotes included, one of which is one of the sponsors of the bill, one of the supporters of the bill, saying that, yeah, well, if America becomes less white because of this, I'll eat the bill, to try and say that it won't do that. You know, he's like, oh, what a ridiculous thing to say.
I want to know who this is, because if they're still alive, they've got a lot of eating to do.
Yeah.
I don't know. Have you ever seen these bills? They're huge.
Oh, yes, they are huge. One thing I do appreciate about like the Ron Paul style of republicanism is just like keep it to one page if you can.
Oh, that's funny. Speaking of which, so we do propose legislation on our website, and we try to keep it very simple. We have a couple right now. There's the Remigration Act of 2025 that we put out last year, and we're in discussions right now with a few people in Congress to see if this is really something that could be put forward in a practical way. And the other is the Immigration Act of 2006, and or sorry, 2026. We're 20 years later in the future. I was thinking about reversing the. I was thinking about your Immigration, Asylum, and Naturalization Act of 2006.
There are plenty of pieces of legislation we would love to reverse.
Right. But no, so on our website, we have a few of these proposals, and we keep them short, but hopefully nobody's going to have to eat them. So that's pretty incredible.
Fingers crossed. Well, you would hope to be keeping your promises.
Right. That's true. In any case, I think so the original question that you asked too was about legal immigration. And so I think it goes back to the idea of number one, the United States, the UK, Western nations are not economic zones. The purpose of the nation state is to promote the welfare of the people who created it. The other argument for legal immigration is around jobs. And in the UK, particularly in, let's see, how many work visas do you guys have? You guys have a very, very large number of work visas. And during COVID, that was expanded significantly to allow for foreign medical students, foreign doctors, foreign nurses, totally understandable. However, the COVID crisis is over and that number hasn't been reduced. And what you're seeing is in the EU right now, 15% of young males are unemployed. And we need to be worried about them and their welfare. It's a moral duty for us to be worried about their welfare over the welfare of foreigners. So resources need to be directed towards training British doctors. And on top of that, so we have both there's the medical field, and then there's also work visas for what we would call low level jobs, which are things like housekeeping, agriculture. With the advancements in automation, with AI, you're gonna see a lot of those jobs disappear. So we're accepting not only people who are filling jobs that are about to go away, but we're also looking at spending money on their dependents as well, because they will have children, they need to be educated, they are using welfare in many cases for their dependents. And so again, we have, even if they're here legally, legal immigration is still a problem, because our priority, we need to shift that focus back to our young men and women, not foreigners.
Yeah, and there's a question regarding remigration that I've always got in the back of my head, that we've mentioned that you've got an international perspective on remigration and the policies that you'll be approaching, because of course it wouldn't be enough within Europe for just one country to reverse the demographic changes. You do really require, especially in a larger economic zone like Europe, which does identify itself as a kind of open borders economic zone to a certain degree, you need cooperation between a lot of different states. One of the other things that I consider is that you do need somewhat cooperation with the countries that these people are returning to as well. So for instance, you look at the case of Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India right now. It seems that one of his primary negotiating tactics with any trade deal he does is, I'm going to throw in a couple of million Indians with you. So on a geopolitical strategic level, he's trying to enhance and expand Indian foreign international power by making it so that he has outposts of populations within each country that he's dealing with, which can grant him a number of advantages in many different ways. So if, for instance, even if they all came through legally, we decided that, you know, Indians, you're really lovely people, we get along with you, but you come from a foreign culture, we don't want you to be here, but we're going to give you these benefits so that you can get back to your own home country. How do you deal if Narendra Modi all of a sudden decides, well, I'm just not going to take them. How do we deal with, on the international stage, with potentially uncooperative nations not wanting returning populations that in many ways could disadvantage them and end up dependents for their nation states as well?
Yeah, you bring up a really good point. The trade deal with the migration component as part of the negotiation is egregious and atrocious. India has 45 million surplus males that they want to export. And they have 10 million people in India who graduate university every year. And this is an absolute and utter disaster for the EU. Again, you know, we go back to the figure of 15% of young people in the EU are unemployed. This is now we've introduced essentially unlimited competition at lower wages. And again, it's a culture that does not believe in a lot of the same things and ideals that Western civilization promotes. For example, they have many child brides. That is not something that we support in the EU. And we have an image right now that puts this into perspective on our website. I think it's either the last article that we put up or the one before, but it's an image that depicts the population of India in the center and then every EU country around the corner of it. And India is larger than all of them combined. So this is a total disaster. Going back to your question, which was, okay, we got ourselves in this mess. We want to remigrate people back to their home countries. How do we get them to take them? Well, there's a particularly humorous example from the U.S. last year where President Trump was sending two military planes over to Colombia with deportees to go back to Colombia. Well, the Colombian president said, you won't be able to land. I don't want to accept these refugees or I don't want to accept these people back into my country. Well, Trump announced immediate sanctions of 25 to 50% on Colombian goods, and the Colombian president reversed course in a matter of hours. He capitulated. So there are things like economic incentives. Another thing that we promote a lot on our website is foreign aid. So there are many countries that are dependent on foreign aid. Instead of sending military aid, we could send aid to rebuild housing. I was at a meeting last Monday, and I was discussing this topic with a fellow who is working on a project in Syria to build schools, because Syria, if I'm sure you're familiar with this, has one of the worst migrant crises in recent history. They had 8 million people leave after the fall of Bashar al-Assad. They've had actually quite a significant pull of the return of their diaspora. That's something we want as well. That's something even mainstream people, mainstream parties are talking about in Germany, is how do we remigrate these Syrians? So the gentleman I was talking to said, one of the things that the issues that we face is the people want to return, but their homes have been destroyed. So the foreign aid that was going to military operations could instead be redirected towards housing development. And this is something that they want and they rely on. And so if we refocus on making these home countries safe and habitable, then of course they'll start accepting their people back. They want that. In India, going back to your original example, we actually have an Indian writer who's written in to the website, and he works for a tech company in India. And he says, you need to stop offering these incentives in your countries, such as the H-1B program, because we need Indian executives here in India to build our economy. So there is discussion to be had there.
Yeah, that's interesting, the idea of using economic tools like sanctions, and then also I'd not considered the foreign aid aspect of it as well. And with the Indians, one of the another one of the arguments against the legal migration that I think a lot of people would be able to accept is I read another interesting article where you were discussing on the website the Patel Motel Cartel, as it's known as, and how the thing that facilitated that was because Indians are not classified under American demographic policy as being white, they were immediately eligible once they got off the plane for small business loans from the Small Business Administration, which are supposed to be able to pull up formerly disadvantaged non-white populations. So I would imagine the reason for something like that being put into law was so that, say, black business owners who could be said to have been historically disadvantaged, you know, they want to start a corner shop, they want to start, I don't know, some business so they can get this loan. These Indians who do not have a history of historical misrepresentation in America just get off the boat and they're like, fantastic, we are already a hotel or an inn-owning family. We'll just get a small business loan and then just take over this entire industry across America. I believe the statistic that was cited in it was that, you know, 100 years ago, it would have been almost 100% white Americans owning these hotels and motels across the country. Now it's like 60% Indian. That's
exactly right. The name the Patel Motel Cartel comes from the fact that the another interesting a tidbit is that the last name of a lot of these Indians who are in the hotel and motel industry, their last name is Patel. And that's because in India, they have a very strong caste system. And you will find a lot of the people with this last name will be filtered into that, the hospitality caste. And so it's actually ironic. We have a Indian in my small hometown right now who just opened up. He's opening up a hotel. He's nice. I like him. But his last name happens to be Patel. It's very funny.
I'm English. I live in England. So obviously I've known plenty of Indian corner shop owners. And they're all routinely very, very nice people. Obviously, with the expansion of Indian immigration over the past few years through Modi's policy, through Modi's policies, you know, we're getting a massive influx of, shall we say, less enterprising people coming from that country who are sort of like destroying the country's reputation internationally. I think that's one of the interesting things that's happened over the past few years. India's reputation internationally has started to sag just a little bit, you could say. But my historical, like, knowing people of Indian descent, has most of them have been very nice for the most part, but that doesn't mean they should be able to displace me in my own nation.
That's right. And it's important to recognize that this isn't a value judgment against other people. We understand that other people have their own cultures. They like them. We like them. We like to go visit them. But we simply don't want to be displaced. And actually, the last time I was in London, it was exactly a year ago now. And this is something that other people have mentioned to me too. I was there and I was really excited to visit, right? Americans love England. And despite what happened in 1776, we have a huge affinity for you guys. There's a reason the British baking show is so popular. But but when I was there, one of the things that struck me was how non-British London really is. All of the service personnel in restaurants or in my hotel were either Indian or Eastern European. And that was really disappointing for me. And again, it's nothing against those individuals. People move for economic reasons. I certainly have. There is something sad when that culture is displaced and lost. And it's okay to feel bad about that and say, no, we want that back. In fact, it's a very uniquely Western thing to do, to sort of set our own interests aside in favor of other cultures. Whereas other cultures, like Indians want India to be Indian. Indians want America to be Indian. Just look at Vivek Ramaswamy.
Well, yes, I saw I suspect it was James, was it James Kirkpatrick wrote an article for the website responding to Vivek's question of what an American is. It was listed as James K on the website, so and it read like a Kirkpatrick article, so. But I might be wrong.
Oh, no, that's not James Kirk. Well, James Kirkpatrick has several names. James I can't give his full last name yet. There, it's interesting.
Apologies.
You know, we talk about how whites aren't allowed to stand up for our own interests, but other people groups are. There are still wild social sanctions and economic sanctions against people who will write under their real names. So we do have people who... They hold PhDs, they're in university positions, they're in policy positions, and they're writing for us, and they can't reveal their names. So it's not Kirkpatrick, but no,
That's
you're
just
right.
An
yeah,
assumption
he
from
wrote
my
an
side.
impassioned.
It was a good article.
Thank you. I like James Kirkpatrick too. I hope he writes for us. Actually, there's something that I'm hoping is going to come in, fingers crossed, in the next week or two. But no, it was an impassioned response against Vivek. It's not our country is not just your economic zone. It's our heritage, and you can't just come here and take that.
Yeah, well, so on the subject of value judgments, as you said a moment ago, it's not about value judgments. I'm going to have to play devil's advocate for a moment here, because some people would argue that there is a value judgment in that we saw recently the Democrat in Texas, I believe his name was Gene Wu, the Chinese expat, saying that actually it's a good thing to displace whites. And many would argue that demographic change to reduce white populations across the US and the West is at the very least a value neutral thing, if not just an outright good thing, due to white people's historic impact on the world. So what would you say in response? Why is it important that whites remain strong majorities in these countries?
And I should clarify there, when I say value judgment, I mean that I'm not making a value judgment against the existence of other cultures.
Of course.
In fact, they should exist in their own countries. I think that that's great. But there, no, it's okay to make a value judgment and say that our countries are for us. And when you have people who identify as Chinese American, like Gene Wu, saying that, yes, we need to displace our oppressors, then that's a problem. And there's actually, there's a gentleman who's running for attorney general in Texas right now, and he openly called for the denaturalization of Gene Wu. That would be something in your country, you could do that. The Home Secretary could do that, because he would be considered not conducive to the public good. And I think we need to be thinking that way in America too. We are not, we've accepted this narrative that whites are oppressors, or Westerners are oppressors of the world for so long. We don't have to accept that anymore. We created our countries for our own prosperity. For in the United States, the Constitution reads for us and our posterity. That is a naturally good thing, and we need to defend that. What Gene Wu is suggesting and hinting at is what we're seeing in South Africa today, where you have a majority non-white population that has significant resentment against the Afrikaners for apartheid, or, you know, there are various reasons, and their land is being seized without consent. They're being brutally murdered. So I'm really glad that there's a lot more attention now focused on South Africa. We did an interview with Ernst Roots of the, it was formerly known as the Pioneer Initiative, and Joost Strydom, who is the representative for Orania right now. I'm glad that they're getting a lot more attention, because what we're seeing in South Africa, that's what our future looks like if you allow people to become a majority in your country who hate you and then hold you responsible for any of their social ills. So it's desperately important that we tackle this problem now and that we're assertive about our interests and that we're not afraid to stick up for ourselves.
And on that, is there not an issue with white birth rates in Western countries? Does a falling birth rate demand replacement migration? Is there a connection between the two? With replacement rates as they are, is it not the only way to buoy up our country's economies? I mean, I've heard always that they're a fiscal net positive, although I have been sent an article that you can find on the White Papers Policy Institute Twitter account that seems to suggest the opposite.
Right. So we published a few articles on this, and this is one of the topics that I spoke on at the Remigration Summit last year, which is that these migrant populations actually depress the wages of the native population, and they are overall a net negative if you look at taxes. So even if you have legal migrants coming in, one of the studies that we brought up was a Dutch study by their own government that revealed that non-Western immigrants were a net negative by about 17. I think the figure was 17 million euros. It's been a while since I looked at that figure, but that is a net negative. And it's interesting that they outlined non-Western as well. If you look at the UK, for example, we just came across data and we tweeted about it. We haven't written an article about it yet, but the data by the Office of National Statistics reveals that native British are the only people who are a net positive in taxation. Every other people group is a net negative. And so I understand the argument that people make about needing more labor, needing more workers. The answer to that is not by importing foreigners, who are going to be. And statistically, you know, against this, again, this isn't just a judgment against people groups because I don't like them. And this is what the science says and the statistics say. These people are going to be a fiscal drain on your society. And that we simply can't afford to have them here at the end of the day.
All right. And how much more time do you have left? Because I've got a few more things I want to ask.
Oh, I've got about we can go for another 20, 30 minutes if you want.
Oh, that's great in that case. So some of the recent events that have happened in America have been very contentious, such as the ICE raids in Minneapolis, Minnesota, some of the footage that came from those, and the ultimate decision to temporarily at least pull ICE out of Minneapolis, which could be seen by some as some poor moves to maybe dim public appetite for remigration or mass deportations. But there is a lot of other stuff going on with Donald Trump's second term thus far regarding different pieces of legislation that have been put forward, different blocks on parts of the administration and pull factors. How would you say that Donald Trump's second term has been so far in how it's helped or hurt the remigration cause?
I think it's been phenomenal. You brought up the recent news in Minneapolis in that area, and that is something that I've noticed. There's a distinction between European attitudes on this and American attitudes on this. I've noticed that Europeans tend to be a lot more skittish when it comes to looking at deportations, but I think it's because you don't have internal deportations over there the same way that we do in the United States. I don't know where the there are a lot of voluntary deportations, and that's great, but there isn't just some. A friend of mine put it this way, there's not a reservoir somewhere of illegal immigrants where we can all just go quietly pick them up, where they're going to be out of sight and then remove them. That doesn't exist. They are out in public. They are working jobs. We do know them. It doesn't have to be violent. The reason that Minneapolis has had so much international attention is because the local police enforcement is not cooperating with the ICE agents. So you've got these people out here who are simply trained to go pick up illegal immigrants, and they should be picking them up at the jails because the police should have already arrested them. They should be waiting there for them. It should be easy. They're not trained to deal, they're not riot police. They're not trained to deal with that. But the government of Minnesota has been so anti-Trump that they've refused any police protection for the ICE agents. And that's one of the reasons that you're seeing what you're seeing. It's not, you don't get the news out of Texas where there is local police protection and they are cooperating. So I do think that the things that you're seeing out of Minneapolis are not the norm. They shouldn't be the norm, and they wouldn't be if the local government would cooperate. These things could be peaceful. A lot of the violence that you're seeing could be prevented if local law enforcement cooperated, but they're not.
No, that makes perfect sense. And what, in regards to some of Trump's other policies, what has particularly stood out to you?
I would say I love the fact that we have an incentive right now through the ZBB OMAP to go ahead and take advantage of that stipend. That is something that's never been brought up before, and it opens up the conversation for voluntary remigration. One of the things that we promote, again, the second half of the remigration proposal for the UK and also for the US includes a stipend for people to return home. So now that's in the national conversation, and you can't ignore the fact that people are ready to voluntarily deport themselves because they want to go home. They see it as economically viable, and they're going to take advantage of that. So I think that that's huge.
Fantastic. And so returning to something we spoke about earlier about all of the different kinds of perspectives on remigration that have been put forward since the term came into vogue. So in the UK, probably the foremost advocate for remigration online, at the very least, is Steve Laws. Now, I know Steve Laws. I consider myself very friendly with Steve Laws. We've had him on the website before for an interview that Dan did with him, and he went on to Andrew Gold in December, I believe it was. Now, he has been criticized for maybe being a bit too maximalist and unrealistic in his approach, and he was criticized and defended kind of in equal proportion for how he came across on the Andrew Gold interview. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with all of that. So I would like to get your take on that, and I would like to hear your assessment of the benefits and drawbacks of his approach as opposed to yours, and whether there are better alternatives in the UK that you would want to point people towards. Obviously, if you just agree with everything that he's doing and saying, that's fantastic. You don't have to. I'm just curious because he's like the number one guy. Who else could you point people towards as well in our country?
So, in terms of Steve Laws, I saw the interview that you're referring to with Andrew Gold. I thought that it was definitely confrontational between the two of them. And but here's the thing. He does take a maximalist approach. His approach is he wants every single person of non-British origin to be deported. He doesn't say exactly how or what that looks like. The way I view Steve Laws would be, I think he's a metapolitical vanguardist position. So what I mean by that is you're always going to have people who push for your idea, but further than what you might encourage or want. And that's fine and that's natural. And it's something that it pushes the Overton window towards what we would consider reasonable remigration procedures. So there's a big, I think the first the first third of the interview, I think, is about him saying, "Yes, I would deport you as well because you're Jewish." And I don't like to get into those particular conversations because I, again, we go back to thinking of people as not economic units. We're not. It's one thing to have a political ideal and a political philosophy that you strongly believe and advocate for. Real life, it ends up being a little bit more squishy. And we do see intermarriage between people of different ethnicities and different cultures. And it is rare, but it happens. And we think that love is a good thing. And I think that naturally, that doesn't happen very frequently. It happens probably more often now because when you eliminate borders and people have more exposure to each other, then yeah, people are going to intermarry. But rates of intermarriage are still very low. And people naturally don't do that because the happiest unions are between people who are genetically similar to each other. I also think that we don't need a particularist, maximalist approach because remigration is and having countries that have a natural ethnic majority is something that human beings naturally gravitate to. So we don't need any social engineering to break people apart. And I think once we assert what has been the cultural norm for most of human history, once we reassert that, you're not going to have to start picking families apart. I think that we're just naturally going to, again, self-select like we always have done. For eons, for all of human history. So, I think that, so yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not going to disavow Steve Laws. I would just say I disagree on that particular point. I wouldn't rip Andrew Gold out of his house and deport him to Israel. But I think that it's fair for him to say that if he wants to say that. I think that he should be a part of the political conversation. Other people that I would point to are, I think that I follow Rupert Lowe. I think he's really interesting. I think he's very practical, practically minded in the same way that we are. We did a review on his immigration policy, so that's something that is very much in line with something that we promote. I also would point people towards the Austrian activist Martin Sellner. He has a book on remigration that just came out in
With
English.
Imperium.
Yeah. So I think that I would point people in that direction. But again, I wouldn't disavow Steve Laws either. I think that he's saying what he wants to say. And I think he's also an example of I don't want to say anger, but like he's an example of the frustration of European males who find that they are now competing with the entire third world and now with India for jobs, for their livelihood, for families. They have every right to be angry and to be mad about that and want dramatic solutions. And so I think what he's saying is perfectly valid and it comes from a valid place. And I would say that our remigration policies are something that can, we can prevent civil war by instituting remigration policies because you're going to find happier young men who have job opportunities, who are trained up, who can have families. That's what everybody wants. You're going to have a more homogeneous society with more altruism, higher trust, higher social trust. And again, coming back to It's all about the economy. If people can have families and they have high social trust and communities, that's something that we're aiming for. So no, I wouldn't disavow him at all. But
Of
that's
course,
not necessarily our approach.
I
We
would
want
never
something to
ask
be
you to disavow
electable.
him. I was curious on your take on him and his approach. So, last proper question now. So, obviously, in the US right now, you have Donald Trump and his administration who are seen to be very pro mass deportation, pro remigration, and we know for the sorts of policies that you're proposing, they don't get anywhere unless you have institutional support, institutional influence, patronage, people who can actually take the policies that you're proposing and then put them into practice. So, with America at the moment, you have a president who is already in a position to start to implement a lot of this stuff and has started to implement a lot of this stuff. Outside of this immediate moment, though, this has to be a a multi-presidential thing, a multi-administrational thing. In the UK, we need it to be across governments, within different institutions, where different think tanks need to be pushing all of this. What kind of plans do you have at the moment, if you can say, for institutional change, promotion of your policies? What could you say to other people watching this right now as how to get their foot in the door and get this cemented as a kind of policy for the future, as a kind of policy that we can put to people as being inevitable in the way that Blair was able to present his policies as being inevitable? How can we change, in what ways we can right now, the kind of culture, again, in the way that Blair set up all these quangos and NGOs that he would ensure that he was that they were all permanently pushing his agenda that he set? We need those kinds of institution ourselves. What kind of plans do you have for that if you don't already have something in the pipeline for all of that?
No, I'm glad that you bring up the fact that it has to be a cultural institutional change. And you're right, there are we need NGOs, we need institutions, we need think tanks that are promoting remigration. And more importantly, we need think tanks that have it right from the start. They're Are many definitions of remigration, as you alluded to earlier, and it can get a little hairy. The first iteration of remigration with the Trump administration was simply getting rid of illegal immigrants. We don't want to stop there. Remigration is fixing the demographic damage that has been done to our countries without our consent over the ever since the 1965 Immigration Act. Ever since we've had this essentially mass marketing campaign for economic liberalism, if we're going to be successful combating that, it has to be a mass marketing campaign of our own. We're in a unique time period right now where the internet is opening up. There's still some censorship that we're experiencing. For example, we are on X, and however, we were denied our application for monetization for subscriptions based off of hateful content for some reason. So we're in the process of appealing that. I think that it's just something that perhaps the AI robots pick up on. If you talk about ethnicity at all, maybe that's something that they pick up on. But so we're still facing some censorship. But I do think that after COVID in particular, people, after COVID and after Elon Musk bought X, I think that we have an opportunity now to change internationally the culture and the conversation and to get our ideas out there. And it's urgent. And for us in the United States, we have just a few more years of the Trump administration. Hopefully, there's a Vance administration after that that we can continue to push these policies, but it is a very limited time period. And so people need to act now. Financially is probably the most important, number one way that you can support, because we need to be able to pay people the way the left pays people to run their institutions. We need to get people out there lobbying. We need to get people out there writing. We need to get people out there influencing and exposing our views. And we have a very limited time period in which to do that. So I would definitely say, come visit us, find ways to support. We've done letter writing campaigns in the past. In the United States, we have you can write your congressional representatives. In the UK as well, you have to join a political party. You have to get your voice out there, and you have to be repeating the idea and the necessity for re-migration so that your elected leaders see that are going to be held accountable, that they can't be signing things like the migration pact or these trade agreements that allow foreigners to compete with you for your jobs and your livelihood. So I think that's where the fight is. So online sharing content, contributing, lobbying, writing, lending your voice in any way that you can, that is very important, and it's really time sensitive.
Of course, I always say that there needs to be a strong patronage network of people who are sympathetic and supportive of these ideas, who have a sense of national pride and historical understanding, need to come out of the shadows and support us. And I do think that more serious, more formal institutions like the White Paper's Policy Institute certainly grant a much greater air of legitimacy that can entice those kinds of backers and funders to come out and support for the agenda that we're looking for. Is there anything else you'd like to say or promote or let people know you're working on before we finish?
Oh, right. Okay. So probably the most important things for your viewers are going to be the British Remigration Policy Platform. So please definitely look that up on our website. We also have an article called An Immigration Policy, as if the British people mattered. And these are the things that are most pressing over the next 5 years, over the next 12 years, is to restore that demographic balance. And you can restore that demographic balance through re-migration. And then once you have appropriate immigration policies in place, you can maintain that for years and ages to come. Again, I want to go back to this Civil War idea. And this is one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you. And I really want to get this idea of re-migration out there because I've been watching David Betts. I don't know if you follow him.
I'm
He is
familiar
a
with him. He's Mr. Civil War, isn't he?
Yes, Mr. Civil War. So yeah, he's in the War Studies Department at King's College London. And I read Civil War Comes to the West when it came out in, I think that was right around 2015 or 2016. And I saw his recent interview on Tucker Carlson, and I also saw his interview on trigonometry. And one of the things that he brings up is that right now we have all of the factors for a brewing civil war. There's factionalism, which is there are different ethnic groups, different factions within the same country who are fighting for status and resources. You have the collapse of social trust, and this is exacerbated probably by the polarization that you see on the internet. So these factions can find each other faster, and organize more efficiently due to social media and the internet. And then three, we have the economic failure of the government to provide opportunities, and the abject failure of the government to stick up for the interests of the native population. And I see him going on these podcasts. I would love to talk to him, where he sees this, but there's no hopeful solution provided at the end of it. The same is true with David Caldwell. He wrote a book about the 1965 civil rights movement, and how this has dispossessed the native population in the US. And he had an interview with Tucker Carlson where he talks about how This is disappointing. The United States is falling apart. Our countries are falling apart. And my argument is that civil war is not inevitable. The entropy of our countries and our culture and our society is not inevitable. You can prevent that. It is easily preventable with remigration, with humane and legal remigration practices that can restore the ethnic balance, that can restore peace in our communities and harmony and social trust. So it's not the end, it's the beginning of a new era where we can assert ourselves and have peace in our civilization again.
That's a lovely message to end on. So, thank you very, very much for joining us, Cyan. Where can people find you and where can people find the White Papers Policy Institute?
Thank you. So our website is whitepaperspolicy.org. We are also on Substack. It's whitepapersinstitute.substack.com. We're also on X. It's White Papers Poll. And we're also on Telegram. And on Telegram, our handle is White Papers. And that's HU White Papers. And if you know, you know.
A shout out to our favorite uncle there. Thank you again very much for joining us today, and thank you for sticking with us through this interview. And please check out Cyan and check out the White Papers Policy Institute. They do some fantastic work. I've really been enjoying it recently. So thank you again very much. Take care, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.